Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
You're listening to the sound of London. This is Londonist Out Loud. I'm Quentin Wolfe, and congratulations, London. We have a new mayor. Well, not that new. In fact, a week old already. Has the housing crisis been fixed yet? What's the hold-up? Seriously, Cecil B. DeMille couldn't contrive a more spectacular problem. If Sadiq Khan hasn't already made some serious inroads into this issue, then he is moving too slowly. But I hope he's going to do it. And congratulations to him, of course, on getting the job. I hope he's going to be a great mayor. Commiserations, meanwhile, to all those mayoral candidates who weren't either Sadiq Khan or Zach Goldsmith. I think if I looked across all the media and added up the total words spent telling us that Zach Goldsmith's father was rich and Sadiq Khan's wasn't, that word count would exceed the total coverage for all the other candidates. Did you have that feeling in the polling booth as well when you saw other names there? when you went down, oh, the Lib Dems. Anyway, I think it's a particular accomplishment of us, actually, of London. At a time like this, when there's so much fear-mongering going on, fear-mongering both to try to cow non-Islamist viewpoints into submission and also fear-mongering to sell newspapers. The fact that London has been able to look beyond all of that and vote in somebody without really seeing their religion, without, I think, allowing that to be the deciding factor, is something of which I think we as an electorate can be extremely proud. Anyway, enough about the election. That is done and dusted. We have far more important things to worry about. What we're about to do on this week's show should not be tried at home. You're about to hear two adults look for about 45 minutes at a pile of salt without really talking about salt. This is best left to the professionals.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the light before. Just a song through from your front door.
Hello, I have battled through the elements to be here today. I don't know what it is, it's just a light drizzle and it seems to make everything weigh a lot more. And I'm glad to be tucked away inside, but we're going to be talking about the elements. And the name of the gallery here is Elements Gallery. We're in the East End, we're off the Lower Clapton Road, in the courtyard of a very controversially pronounced Lubomirov and Angus Hughes. And Rebecca Fine is my guest, and she's the curator of a work by Philip Hall Patch, and this is all about salt. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
Can we just take 5 minutes to sit down and get the water out of our clothes?
Yes, that's a very good idea. So, yeah, here we are, and it's a perfect day for it, because Elements Gallery is a space where an artist can come and have their work here for 3 months. It's inspired by the seasons, and our inaugural artist is Philip Hall Patch, who's made a sculpture/installation piece called Saltfield No. 3, which is made out of 4 kilogram blocks of salt. And the idea is that it will dissolve over time and that Mother Nature gets to be the co-author. And that's really what this space is about for us. And that's why he's here for the spring season. And then we'll have an artist who's in for the summer, autumn and winter. And we're actually sitting in the bottom, looking out at the lovely French windows on this typical London rainy day, witnessing the pollution that's being registered, as well as nature of the wind and the rain. But the pollution is the thing that's really striking, because I was very attracted to invite Philip Hall Patch to be our inaugural artist, because I saw some of his work at the Brighton Festival House a couple of years ago, and he'd made work out of salt there. But that was in a gallery context with the kind of the classic thing of the, you know, the walls, the ceiling, whatever. And here it's a chance for his work to really kind of dissolve and develop. And also it illustrates very well what this courtyard space is all about.
Well, you've got to come at a piece of art from all sorts of different angles, I think. And I've got my critical eye in. Critical, not necessarily meaning negative, obviously. Maybe we'll approach how the work is working in nature. It seems very strange to call it in nature in this entirely built environment. But it would be remiss of me not to include a word or two of description of the place, which is absolute pandemonium. By your own description, absolute pandemonium. It's a delightful chaos going on here.
Yes, well, we're kind of seated at the back part. I mean, the courtyard is a very organised kind of space.
The courtyard is by far the most organised element of all of this.
Yes. So because it's a rainy day, we've actually had to come indoors. And so we're in the unseen part of Le Bromhof Angus Hughes. So we're surrounded by the sort of backstage, if you like, area of all the art that you wouldn't see, the inner workings of an art gallery. And I think it's quite delightful. And we were both saying that we feel quite at home with this kind of thing. There's all kinds of stuff. There's artwork, there's wall, there's paint, there's sandbags, there's ladders, there's everything going on. But we're sitting here and we're looking out at Saltfield number 3, which I must just make one point on behalf of the artist. The work, the idea of this is that when people come to the gallery, which is the Bromhof Angus Hughes Gallery, and they see the Elements Gallery courtyard, the sculptural courtyard, is that the idea is the piece has been built to be viewed from up above, the deck up above.
Oh, right.
So there's kind of, you know, that's one of the kind of main viewing. So it's been built for that purpose. So it's in a kind of sort of triangular shape, which is now kind of dissolving and mirroring its own chaos in a way. So the idea is that people come, and every time they come to the gallery and they view the courtyard space, the sculpture will be different at every single viewing. And because we're in springtime and the weather's changing, this was incredibly pristine. The artist's background is in architecture, so these white pristine salt bricks that were placed as part of his Saltfield number 3 were very, very striking. And now it's getting to show the dirt, and you know, it's starting to sort of crumble in on itself, and that's very imposing from the upstairs viewing platform. And the idea is when we have late opening nights, we have one on June the 3rd, and then we have a later one on the last day, which is June the 26th, so people will be able to see from upstairs. And also I bring people down into the courtyard. They can kind of hang out and have a nice time. We've got bamboo, we've got planters here, we've got done our own version of a kind of dry Cornish dry stone wall as well. So on the opening night it was great fun, and people were sort of staying for a long time, and the artist was here to talk about his work as well. So that's the idea, that it will, the work will always be viewed mainly from the upstairs gallery.
So it's been here for how long?
It was launched on April the 8th, just in time for the rainy season, for April showers.
So we've got brick is the word you use, and that's about right in terms of the size of each of these blocks. They remind me very much of the Superman film, you know, that 1970s Superman film with Christopher Reeve. He goes off somewhere in the Arctic, I think, to get a message from his father, Jor-El.
Oh, okay.
And I think we've got a bit of that vibe going on here. And they form more or less into a triangle. And as you say, the tops of them have dipped now, probably under the dissolving of the rain. And some of the blocks on the corners have fallen down. But the most striking thing, the ugliest thing probably about it, is the horrible pollution that we can see creeping up from the bottom. The bottom of these formerly white salt bricks are almost black, and then the dirt climbs up them until we've got a sort of a dirty white at the top. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, no, I think it's fascinating, and I'm quite shocked how much of that is shown. And someone was saying to me the other day, if you kind of take a sample of a Londoner's lungs, it will be like black sticky marmite inside, which is a horrible thought. But obviously we're in a really polluted part.
I wish you hadn't called it a black sticky marmite. That's made it all so much worse.
So it's kind of, or maybe kind of tar, I don't know. But that is quite shocking that it's registering. I mean, we knew it would register the weather, and I think they're lasting incredibly well, considering, because they're industrially manufactured. So they're kind of compressed. The salt is compressed. Each one weighs 4 kilograms. So in front of us is 1.5 tons of salt. which is incredible in itself. But I think it's really interesting. It was one of the things that we talked about when I was discussing it with the artist. We talked about how nature was going to be co-authoring, and we knew it was going to register kind of climatic changes. But the fact that it's actually showing the London pollution so graphically in this kind of way is quite shocking, I think. The whole thing is an experiment.
Well, that's, yes, and you must have had some sort of idea of what you thought it was going to do over the course of that time. I wonder how far away from your expectation this is.
Well, because the idea of Elements Gallery space is I'm inviting artists to actually experiment during that time that they're here, that their work is resident here for that season. And so I want it to register some kind of change. And it's the idea that it's the antithesis of the kind of normal way that we view sculpture, you know, public sculpture, you know, equestrian statues of some colonel on horseback that's going to be there for 200 years. This is the opposite of that. And I think it's more reflective of where we are in London and East London, that it's going to be showing change. And while I'm talking, I can see this, the sun is actually coming out. So at a very advanced stage, it does crystallise more. But that's not happened yet. It's more kind of malformed, kind of sort of sugar lumps in that kind of way. But people get very physical with it. So people want to touch them and hold them as well. And I think some people have moved them around.
Yeah, now that always intrigues me with those open gallery pieces like this, where it sort of encourages interactivity, whether after interaction has taken place, it's clearly not laid out the way the artist originally laid it out. Is it still the same piece of art?
It's still, I think, well, there's kind of two aspects of that. One, this is still very much the formation in the kind of mind's eye of the artist, Philip Hallpatch, and it's still kept within that. But it obviously, some people have moved stuff around, and I think, you know, this being London, urban foxes have come in and done their and contributed to the artwork as well.
In what way have they contributed to it, dare I ask?
I think they're kind of flicking stuff on it as well, and you get bits of twigs and things, and it also encourages wildlife as well, because the thing about salt, which also comes from salt licks, which, you know, farmers will know, they'll put them out for cows and dogs, and we had dogs that visited on the opening night, and of course they love it, you know, because they want to lick the stuff. So but on the wider question of that kind of that's kind of, you know, that old hoary chestnut that's brought up, but is it art? And we were talking about Marcel Duchamp, his urinal launching conceptual art, and the debate still continues even now. But I think it's more about art and the role of art, for me anyway. I can't speak for the artist in this, but for me as a curator, I'm also practicing artist, and I see those things running together, not separate from each other, because this is very much, you know, transforming an urban space, and a lot of my artwork is about that, and that's really important to me. But I think it's about setting questions and making people think. And there's so many, you know, you could have a graph of pollution in Hackney, or you could show this, and this is very striking. So you could bring someone from whatever educational level or background or age or knowledge and show them this, and they would understand what's going on. And I think, you know, there's things like the Wellcome Trust that do a fantastic job of illustrating questions about kind of science, life, urbanism, architecture, whatever, and art being used in that way. And I think the idea that art is always a sort of neat narrative with a beginning, middle and an end, that's just not true. So even great works of art are constantly, that are considered finished paintings, are constantly reinterpreted. So something as iconic as the Mona Lisa has been reinterpreted every 100 years into what its meaning is and who she is. So I think it's a kind of null and void kind of question, in a way, if I cheekily say that, because it's kind of missing the whole point, and it's downgrading it. To me, this is something that anybody can understand, and it literally illustrates it physically.
Well, yes and no. I mean, we've got our sleeves rolled up here, and I wouldn't let anybody else off an awkward question. I guess it's two questions that need to go hand in hand. Yeah. One is, to what degree you need to reverse engineer the questions according to how the thing evolves in a situation like that. And the other is the degree to which the questions need to be asked for the audience, I suppose. Not all of the audience by any means, but it might not be obvious to somebody looking at these blocks of salt that these particular questions should be asked, and therefore they, you know, I'm wondering the degree to which you need to hold their hand as curator.
Well, I suppose there's a bit of both. So I'm kind of in agreement with you up to a point in that, like anything in the world, it's kind of based on language and how you find out. You know, if you want to learn about algebra, then you look at how algebra works. And art is another kind of language. It's in terms of an art form, I think it can be over intellectualized because you can enter into this piece of work at lots of different levels. So the artist is actually currently doing an MA in aesthetics of representation of sculpture, and so that's at a completely different level. But you could take someone who's from the local pensioners club or a five-year-old from the infant school, and I could sit down with them and explain about this piece of work and ask them questions and what they feel about. But what I think is entirely obvious, because it's exposed, where exposed to the elements, is there's no roof. When people come into the courtyard space, they realise this is London that is making these marks on the work. Now, how they choose to interpret that might be up to them, but to me, that's a very obvious thing. So I think it can operate on all those different levels. So you can hold someone's hand up to a point, but I suppose I don't like necessarily the idea of holding someone's hand. It's more showing a pathway, if someone wants to take that, of the different questions that can be asked, how deep do they want to go into it, and also to look at the language to understand it as a piece of art. I suppose the difference, I mean, I'm a fine artist and a curator, but I think if I could have been any type of artist, I would have been a musician, because music is something, I've got all kinds of music with people singing in different languages, which I don't know, but I can still get the mood. If I hear a sad piece of Chinese music, it doesn't have that. And with art, that can sometimes work, but not always. And I think people are disingenuous when they try to say, you know, it's totally open, it's totally accessible. There is a thought process that goes into it, in the same way picking up a book and understanding, you know, if you're picking up a book, I was educated at a comprehensive school. We didn't do Greek mythology. If I want to read Aristophanes or whatever, I need a kind of guide. I need a key guide. That doesn't mean I'm not going to enjoy it or get a great deal out of it, but I need a key guide to take me through that, because I haven't been exposed to that in my educational upbringing.
Well, more than that, you'd benefit from being educated in that in that area in order to speak the language, know the vocabulary, yes, understand some of the symbols.
Yeah, exactly. And I think art is exactly the same. And if you go to any of the, you know, the major museums in London, you know, the National Gallery or whatever, they have talks that they do where they interpret works and they bring them to life for people. So in terms of the symbolism, and that applies just as much to beautiful religious works that we might see and go, oh, that's the Madonna, but why is she always wearing blue? That's because blue was the most expensive, the kind of lapis lazuli was the most expensive colour that an artist could use, so it was seen as the most kind of holy. It was even more expensive than gold. So once you can unpack all those symbols, it can increase your enjoyment of that work. It might not float your boat, paintings of Madonnas necessarily, but we've got a Martin Creed lighting effect going on in the cellar here as well, just to add to it.
Well, I think that's over-interpretation.
So I think, yeah, it can increase your enjoyment of it to understand all the symbols and whatever and help you get into it. And in the end, it still comes down to your personal taste. What, you know, do you really like the colour red? Do you really like kind of oriental art? Do you really like really purist stuff? Do you like stuff that uses flowers or nature? And they're all completely legitimate, but it's more about widening our palette, I suppose, widening our understanding, like reading lots of different types of great literature and how well things are being translated.
Actually, on that subject of accessibility, I think there's something I want to ask you that involves heading down a lift shaft, but we'll come back to that in just a second. We're going to take a very quick word from our sponsor. This episode of Londonist Out Loud is brought to you by Squarespace. Whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, a professional blog, or an online store, it's all included with your Squarespace website. And actually, we decided to put Squarespace through its paces. We're very proud of the London blog we run, but we thought, what the hell, let's try putting another one together in super quick time. So we got on the case using Squarespace. It's very easy indeed. There were some beautiful templates to work with. The customer support was second to none. And within just 1 hour, we'd made a fantastic looking blog all about Peckham. Take a look at our post on the subject, see what you think. Squarespace could not be simpler to use. And because you listen to this show, there's a freebie here for you. You can start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter offer code LONDONIST to get 10% off your first purchase. You're listening to London Is Out Loud. I'm in Quentin Wolfer at Elements Gallery. Rebecca Finer is my guest, and we're looking at A Lot of Salt by Philip Hall Patch. Saltfield number 3?
That's correct.
And we're talking about accessibility of art, and I suppose we're on the edge of public art, but I know that you're a champion of accessible art, which is a loaded word, if ever there was one. But I was looking back over your resume, and some of the work that you've been doing, for example, is in a church belfry, down a lift shaft, in a bank vault. The last thing that sounds is accessible. These are places known for not being accessible.
Well, I think it's more accurate to say probably not very commercial, but accessible in actually what happens, because I'm not a great fan of the kind of white cube gallery space, because there's a great deal of etiquette and expectation that's around that. And so I'm always interested in basically putting art in different spaces. And like you've listed some of them, a bank vault, a lift shaft. And what happens is when the public come to those spaces, and it's also quite frightening for you as the artist, because I kind of tend to stalk and hang around and get their reaction and engage them in conversation, is that they will basically really tell you what they think. But because it's taken out of that white cube space and all that etiquette of the kind of wine and the private view, although that will happen at the launch time, but afterwards, they feel very empowered to tell you what they think, to ask you questions, because they don't feel stupid, because it's unexpected. They were unexpectedly finding a film in a church belfry for the Olympics at St John on Bethnal Green, who I've done a lot of work with. They're lovely people. I did a kind of secular response to the Wailing Wall for the Olympic site, and it was over 8,500 coloured scrolls by EastEnders that was put in the railings by Bethnal Green tube station. And that was the most fantastic thing. And people came back again and again, and it engaged people in conversations, young, old, every shape, size, colour that you can imagine, because they felt empowered. They didn't feel like they were being stupid to ask that question, or to say what they liked or what they didn't like, and to give you the reasons why. So that's a huge reason why I'm attracted to those kind of spaces, because it's unexpected, and therefore they feel somehow liberated. When you have a private view, I mean, people who aren't involved in the art world, these things have just, there's no reason why it should be that way, but it's just evolved. So you have the white cube space, and there's the private view, and there's lots of chinking of glasses of wine, and there's an expected etiquette. Well, I'm sorry, we're in Clapton, we're in Hackney, a lot of in the surrounding community, they would come to that door and then run away. You know, if you're not used to that kind of thing, it doesn't seem like it's not for you, it's not about you, everyone seems to know each other. It's very intimidating. And I suppose there's a lot of etiquette around those white cube spaces, and just how it happens naturally. It's not that anyone's trying to be exclusive, even. It just happens in that kind of way.
Mention the white cube, though, you're referring to it as emblematic of a culture, not that specific gallery.
I don't know Jay Joplin. I've never met him, so so I'm not talking about. I mean the kind of generic gallery space that we all recognise, we all know what it is, etc., etc. But that whole thing in the art scene of what's expected and how you're supposed to behave and whether you're supposed to have knowledge about the artwork or whatever, to someone who's outside that, that just seems completely intimidating to them. And there is a lot of etiquette of how you're supposed to conduct yourself within those spaces, which are unwritten rules. And if you're not from that background, that's very difficult for people to navigate. Now, if it's in a church belfry, or if it's in a lift shaft, or if it's so unexpected. I've done stuff in graveyards and things like that. They come with an open mind as well. You know, the hoary old chestnut we were talking about, you know, is it art? Doesn't really enter their mind. They come completely open. But if it's in a gallery context, a traditional gallery context, then quite often things get kind of enclosed and imprisoned, whether it's within a frame literally or within the space, and then they feel they have to act in a certain way, or should I know about this, rather than just feeling comfortable to go, well, I really love that, but I don't know why.
So having come up from a fine art background, I'm wondering how you came around to that line of thought, because it would seem a path of least resistance to be going down exactly the route you're describing.
Well, I'm not from a fine art background. That's probably why. I'm kind of DIY. I'm self-declared.
Oh, DIY fine art. I love that as a concept.
Unilateral declaration of independence. That's what I say. So,
yes, I've got to say, this place has a bit of the B&Q about it.
Well, we are in the cellars. So upstairs is a beautiful traditional gallery space. size. And the Elements Gallery, the courtyard, is what I was attracted to. And the co-directors of Le Bromofangers Hughes were so open-minded when I came to them and said, oh my God, you've got this fantastic space outside, you know, please let me, you know, when I approached them with the idea, saying, yes, I know it doesn't have a roof, but why can't that be a gallery space? Because in London, space is such a premium. And getting hold of it, to be able to experiment and do stuff. And they've just been incredibly supportive, just like, if you can make it happen, go for it and knock yourself out, which is why it's here today.
We nearly did a word picture of the place earlier on, and it's unusual to leave it this late, but I think it warrants it. The courtyard we're looking into through triple-paned patio-style doors. We've got the work that we were describing. It's about 8 or 10 feet in width, about the same backwards, and it's a triangle. It's just over ankle height, bricks on their ends. Beyond that, we've got the fenced courtyard. There are some mirrors, there are some plants and grasses. Around the corner is a room where a chap, stripped to the waist, was eating a bowl of porridge as I passed by. It's a little car park.
And sorry, I missed that.
Well, you might still catch him, I don't know. You don't know who he is then?
No, I don't know who the porridge eater is.
Well, there's an added attraction now, not just the salt, but the porridge guy.
I'm going to put that on the next flyer.
Down here we've got, well, this, it looks like a woodwork shop, and pretty much is. There are frames that have been chopped into sections, there are angle grinders and rotary saws.
A bit of a tree trunk there.
So there is. The building itself, though, this is East End artist space all over, really. Lots of brickwork, lots of wood beams, a few girders, but the place is in splendid decline.
Yes, but I must make absolutely clear the separation between... We have come into the kind of inners of the gallery building, so this is the side that, you know, you're getting a special sneaky peek in this.
Well, I love this
bit. Kind of, yeah, we're the kind of backstage, where upstairs there's a beautiful, white, pristine gallery where work has been traditionally hung and all the rest of it. So I need to put that. So when visitors come to the gallery space, they won't actually come down here. We're kind of in the inners. We are kind of sort of backstage, which, like you say, is really interesting because you see the inner workings. It's like taking an old radio apart and seeing how it all fits together.
So, yes, it's exactly like that, yes. I'm particularly impressed by this doorway, which essentially looks as though it was made by a rhino being propelled through it at velocity.
Yeah. I don't know what the story is that related to that, but perhaps we could make one up. Historically, this used to be the electricity company used to run it historically, and according to the Hackney archives, I think the suffragettes used to meet here as well. And then William Angus Hughes took it over and set it up as this beautiful gallery space, which is upstairs, not the inners.
Not this, yes.
Not the inners where we're sitting.
Not the bit I think slightly
exactly.
Ashamed of.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And I exhibited here before.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about... work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If. Only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
William Angus Hughes is also a practicing artist as well and a writer. And so he'd been in Den City One, which I did, which was part of the London Festival of Architecture last year. And that was the Hackney Wick response to that. That was my artistic response because lots of architects and planners were coming into the area and it was like, why aren't the artists doing a response? So it was basically a utopian city made out of the detritus of Hackney Wick, which you know Hackney Wick very well. It's absolutely full of it. And I wanted to illustrate the difference in that what we do as artists, you know, Neighbourhood Watch, they would be complaining saying someone dumped a load of tyres outside, where in Hackney Wick someone would say, great, I'm going to make an installation out of that. And so I wanted to kind of share what we do as a kind of living way of recycling, repurposing with the very official London Festival of Architecture. So that's what we did. We had a 3-day festival. It was on a 1.5-acre site. So we had this kind of sort of shanty town of art with the Olympic Stadium in the background, which just kind of amused me. So it's a, you know, similar kind of thing. And then how this came about was that I came and I saw this wonderful space that was neglected, and they did a fantastic job of clearing the space because it was almost like a pyramid of rubble and chairs and things that built up over time. And I said, this could be the most fantastic space. And they've just been really open and letting me run with it and having it as a sort of separate branded space because it's running on a different programme. They have a monthly turnaround, as most traditional galleries do with their exhibitions. And this is based on the elements, which is why I called it Elements Gallery, so that it changes with the season and is inspired by the seasons, and to invite the artists to actually work with the seasons rather than trying to resist them in that kind of way. So that's really how it came about. And also, if you like, it's London's first dedicated space to outdoor art. And although the Serpentine
Yes, that's a very questionable claim.
No one's taken that crown from me yet. It's the Serpentine have their outdoor thing, but that's part of the Royal Parks. They don't own that space. And it's only done temporarily, which is their summer season when they build their pavilion. Sometimes the City of London also has a festival of sculpture, but again, it only happens at specific times. There's other placements of public art in London, like the Economist's Square, where they have public art also. But actually, at the moment, until someone else comes and takes that crown, humble though it is, as a starting point, this is London's first dedicated space to outdoor art, because we, things like the Yorkshire Sculpture Park and its more countryside areas, it doesn't really happen in London. One, because people don't have access to a courtyard, because that's just life. And it's very rare for a gallery to have access to this kind of space or to want to utilise it. It would normally be used as kind of storage. So it was literally me coming along, and I fall in love with spaces like this. It's the type of thing that I love and go, oh, let me do something with this. Let me get my hands on this, see what I can do. So we started it. I'm not from a moneyed or property background, and lots of people who start galleries are. This was done almost by public subscription, and this was started, the initial funding was started with a crowdfunder. So members of the artistic community and other people put in their pennies worth to help make it happen, for us to get that little bit of seed funding to kick us off, basically. So that's why we're here now. People wanted to see it happen as well. So that's another thing that's kind of different. And I think that that makes it quite a special space as well.
What are the practicalities there of getting the momentum behind a crowdfunding thing like that? That's a huge change in how things are done in the last 5-10 years, isn't it? It sounds like it might involve quite a lot of personal salespersonship.
Well, it's very interesting, because the positive side is that it makes you deconstruct exactly what you do. So with the crowdfunders, what they don't kind of publicise is that, you know, they charge you on average a 5% to use their platform. And then obviously PayPal charges you a percentage as well. And then for any rewards that you get for people to pledge for, that's an interesting process, because obviously you have to buy them or you have to do some kind of deal. So for instance, for Elements Gallery, one of the pledges, which was quite popular, was that I went to an East London brewery, Left Bank Brewery, craft ale being a huge thing with microbreweries specifically in East London. And one of the things that you could pledge for was £35 to get
three bespoke ales that were brewed specially for Elements Gallery, with labels featuring the design of the artwork on them in a kind of presentation pack. And they will literally be collector's editions. It's also because I've got a little bit of a punk rock sense of humour, and obviously the Beck's Prize is kind of serious doing it, and I'm doing it in a very kind of, it's not even cottage industry, it's kind of, you know, there's no cottage involved. And so, but that's a whole negotiation, and that still has to be paid for. The labels have to be printed, all of those things have to be paid for. So whatever you raise with your crowdfunder, the headline figure, that's not what you get in your hand, because you've had to do all these different negotiations. And that was just one thing that came up, because I thought, you know, craft ale, that's such a huge thing in East London. Quite a few people went for it, so that's an interesting thing. So you end up going to meet breweries and all the rest of it. Another one was a fine dining experience with an Italian chef in their home that they could pay for. So obviously you've got to cover all the costs of that. So it's a strange beast. It was really interesting to do it. It was utterly exhausting because it's a 24/7 platform. So you have no rest whatsoever. I don't know that I would do it again. I think most people do it when they have a sort of a committee of people, you know, if they're, you know, but literally I was all over it, having to do everything, the social media, the writing of it, the promotions, the rewards, and it's still ongoing now. Oh, the other thing that we did that was a little bit crazy was that our campaign closed on the kind of Easter, and Easter came very early this year. And then we opened on the 8th of April. So there was like a kind of a week in between, which was completely crazy. Sometimes people leave it sort of 2 months. They get the money in, they spend 2 months, and they put it together. But I wanted a really quick turnaround also, so people could see what they'd helped create. And I thought that was really important. And now I'm still going through the process of getting the rewards to different people at different times. And that's a whole rigmarole. So I don't know whether, it was an interesting experience. I don't think I'd do it again as one person kind of curator wearing so many hats, because it just dilutes all the different things that you're good at, because you're having to spread yourself very thinly. It's quite exhausting. And like I said, time-wise, labour-wise, it's still going on now. I'm still having to distribute all this stuff and have meetings with people to make all this stuff happen. But yes, it is a new way of, it's another place that artists can go and try and make their work happen. It's a different way, instead of going through the Arts Council. And I guess in that way, it's very, very free, because you say what you want to do and why you want to do it. And obviously it has to be something that people socially engage with, because there is stuff there where people just want money to, seems like, for themselves to be paid to go on a photography holiday around Vietnam or whatever. So that this is for other people. It wasn't for me, not even directly for the artist as well. So I think that kind of captured people's imagination. So that's my advice if someone's trying to do crowdfunding, to actually think about the social purposes of what they're doing. Otherwise, unless you've got very rich family, which I don't, then that they're going to back you to do whatever your artistic adventure might be. But if you want to engage strangers, people that you don't know, then you've got to have something else. That would be my top tip for it. And forget about sleep for 6 weeks as well.
Well, another aspect of your life, and I wonder how all this has impacted on it, is your art.
Ah, yeah. Well, I suppose for the moment, I've decided to kind of sort of very much fuse the two together, because I've always been, even the word curator, I'm not sure that I really like that. It's just that people understand what that is, because I think I'm a kind of cultural producer as much as a curator. I don't just kind of point at things and say that would look pretty there. I get much more involved than that, and I'm much more collaborative, and we've got the rest of the programme for 2016, and I'm going to be working much more collaboratively with the artists, actually supporting them. It's more a kind of sort of cultural producer in a way, to actually make things happen. I prefer the word kind of cultural catalyst, actually, rather than curator, because people now, you know, they curate their Facebook page, they curate their playlist, they curate. It's a kind of word that's, along with the word affordable in London, or luxury, is also become slightly meaningless.
Yeah, you're pressing my buttons there.
But it's true. A friend of mine came to stay with me. You hadn't been in London for many years. And I said, you need to know, in the lexicon of London, there's a couple of words that don't mean anything. The word luxury, you know, when I was growing up, actually meant luxury, something palatial, something beautiful, whatever. But now it doesn't. Now it can be like a garage with a for sale sign on. And the word affordable, as in terms of kind of housing or studios or anything,
you know, 80% of market rate, and the market, we all know, is a kind of wild beast. And so that word doesn't really mean anything. Outside London, I know it's a completely different story, but in London, which is just a kind of crazy hothouse of that stuff, it doesn't mean anything. And so the word curator as well, I use that because people understand what it is, so it's a kind of shorthand. But if someone's actually speaking to me for more than one sentence, I would say creative catalyst, making things happen. I prefer that. So.
Not sure about that one. But just by the way, entirely in parenthesis, I was looking at a property website the other day just to... because
just for amusement.
Just for amusement, yes. Really to press my nose against the shop window from the outside. And I discovered that £50,000 buys you, not too far away from London, a field that definitely won't get planning permission, or a garage.
Right. Well, yeah, there you go. See, a garage. Yeah. I mean, it's just crazy. It's just complete, and it becomes harder and harder. And that's why I see, when you ask me about my art, and I meandered slightly, it's my Irish roots coming out there with storytelling. But going back to the art, I see the two as absolutely fused together, because in terms of my art and what I do and what I'm interested in doing, and going to interest in unusual spaces or spaces that you wouldn't normally see art, and getting access, you know, a little tear in the fabric of time, which means that you can get access to, you know, like a 1.5-acre site by the Olympic Stadium or a warehouse in Hackney Wick to make something happen. But it does become quite exhausting, because you go into this whole thing of it's temporary. And what's great about this as a platform, and that Le Bromhof Angus Hughes have been so supportive, is that this has a kind of permanence about it. So it's something that can be built on, because artists are forever nomadic, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's also very tiring, because you don't get to build on anything. You don't get to create something that's properly sustainable.
Well, that's the artist themselves who is that thing that's being built up, is it not?
How do you mean?
Well, your exhibits themselves might be temporary or transient or nomadic, but they cumulatively add to the reputation of the artist.
Yes, I suppose so. But if I'm talking about art spaces where you'll get a load of artists together to try and make something happen, there's an enormous amount of energy and time and labour that goes into that, and commitment and passion. And then that might only be for a very, you know, because there's been lots of pop-up, you know, you've got pop-up shops everywhere, and it's a similar kind of thing. And you've got, you know, pop-up art galleries as well, an enormous amount of time and energy going to something that might only be there for a weekend.
It's difficult for us to ignore what's going on outside.
Yeah. Well, it looks like we've got excitement. That sounds like fire and police.
I presume that's Sadiq Khan going off to do something about the housing shortage.
yeah, possibly, yes, to kind of put some foam on some estate agents' fees, where they want to charge you £200 for checking your reference by email. Nice work if you can get it.
Yes, absolutely. Well, actually, I wanted to ask you about that, because it's with the skill set you've got, and I often think this when I'm interviewing somebody in the arts who's, I don't know how many people have got the same sort of profile as you, but somebody who's had to go through the construction of businesses, the selling of an idea, yeah, the taking of opportunities and generating something and getting it to stand on its feet. It often seems to me that art is really commercially and financially not the horse to bet on. And I wonder whether it's ever crossed your mind to take the skills that you've got and apply them to something that makes a bit more money.
Well, I suppose, yeah. I would like to eat a bit more regular, yeah.
Or ever, you know.
Yeah. I must be looking very thin today, yeah. But, I suppose in the kind of art thing, it's that thing of kind of following your passion, doing what you love, and all the other kind of sacrifices that you make along the way. But I suppose the question that you've posed is very interesting. It's more from a kind of wider perspective, is that why aren't those skills more recognised? Because it's incredibly entrepreneurial, working with volunteers, motivating people quite often for free because you can't pay them wages, and how to make things fun, how to get people engaged. And yes, you're right, I suppose those are all skills that people corporatise in terms of kind of leadership or bringing groups together and get people, teamwork, all these different types of things, publicity. But it doesn't really get recognised. And there's that classic thing, going back to your comment about the estate agent and the field for £50,000 or a garage, in that it's such a strange thing, because
commercially, estate agents recognise that having a whole bunch of artists and artist activity in an area, earlier we were talking about Hackney Wick, actually makes it cool, increases the kudos, they're going to make things happen, they're going to see detritus and paint it fantastic colours, they're going to plant things. They recognise the value of that, but it's very difficult to get, you know, municipal authorities to recognise the value of that, or other kind of institutions or grant-giving bodies to actually realise that creativity is a kind of messy kind of thing. But, yeah, the estate agents recognise and literally monetise the value of that. They will actually advertise saying, oh, creative community, artists, da-da-da-da-da, because they know what that is. That's actual physical, environmental and cultural improvements, whether someone trying to start a tiny little coffee bar, or they've painted a wall with some fantastic mural, and they recognise it and they quantify it and they turn it into pounds, shillings and pence, and it's just getting other people to recognise it. That's the difficult thing. I don't really know why that doesn't happen. I don't know the answer to that, really. I don't know the answer to that, but it's a kind of mystery why those skills aren't recognised. But I think the nature of being an artist is that you are, you know, again, for me, I am much better at selling somebody else's work and promoting somebody else's work rather than your own thing. It's quite difficult. And I think artists tend to be not necessarily so articulate about talking about their own work. That's quite a difficult thing, because the, you know, the reason why you're making work is because you want to explain something visually, not verbally. I mean, unless you're a playwright or something like that. So,
even then.
Yes. Well, that's true. And I think that's the nature of it. If you could do it a different way, then you would do it a different way. And that's why you're in that field of creating, whether it's objects or beautiful things for people to look at or listen to, because that's your way of communicating, you know, heartbreak or loneliness or love or a statement on what's happening with Syrian refugees. That's what you're going to do if you're a songwriter. You're going to write a song about it. It might touch more people than writing a kind of sort of annual report on it as well, but for some reason it doesn't get quantified in that way. And I don't really know the answer to that mystery.
Clearly, we're coming, unfortunately, towards the end of our time here, I've got two questions up the spout. One of them is that it's obvious that it's easier to get hold of a piece of art if there are ideas attendant to it that are sort of recognisable, flaggable, upable. But I wonder, through the work of others that you're putting on and planning to put on, and indeed through your own work, aside from the themes, the ideas, the concepts, I wonder if there's a mood that the music there tends to have.
Oh, in my own work?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I suppose...
Or in the artistic choices you make.
Okay, well, I guess there's two types of work that I make. There's a very... stuff that's very, I consider quite kind of personal to me, which looks at, I suppose, the institution of the family from a very political kind of way, because, you know, and how we deal with that and all those features that go with that in terms of it, the family as an institution actually being politically very interesting, sociologically, and also quite a dangerous place as well for women in particular at any age. And at the same time, that's a very revered institution. We're always getting it fed to us. That's fine. And also it's a way that even if you're not from a family, that you kind of arrange life anyway. I think you were talking about warehouse living before, and those are types of informal families. So I'm very fascinated by that. And my work will involve installation or text, or it might involve film. And that's very personal stuff that I look at. And then there's the other side of stuff where I do give it away, or it involves a lot of social engagement and I hope humour as well. And that the audience will actually contribute, whether it's using luggage tags or, like the piece that I said, the secular response to the Wailing Wall, where 8,500 EastEnders and visitors to London filled this huge, vast scape and made this fantastic rainbow of colour of all their kind of prayers and wishes and thoughts. And although I started off the pattern, they contributed and made it into something that I didn't know what it was going to be. So there's kind of two extremes. There's a very kind of private, thoughtful stuff, and then there's the very outward, bit more extrovert stuff that involves a lot more public engagement. And one is a much more controlled side, and the other one is a complete rip, letting go. So there's those two dialogues going all the time in what I do in terms of my
personal work. But I think I do need to say something that how I came to be an artist was that, and this is going to trigger another whole thing, is that I did a show because I dreamt it. I dreamt the whole thing. And then because it was dealing with childhood sexual abuse in my family, two of my brothers came and smashed it up, and I had to go to court myself and get an injunction. And it was kind of baptism by fire as an artist, because I literally had to fight for it. And I've been involved in arts ever since. So it's quite a strange thing. That was at the Foundry of the early days. Originally, it was called Family Room in Continuum, and that was smashed up by various members of my family. And then afterwards, I got a court injunction to be able to exhibit again, and then it was changed to Speak Out or Consent. So it had kind of strengthened itself.
They're not big on spotting irony, your family, by the sense.
Well, there wasn't. It wasn't really about them. It was about my survival journey. It wasn't really about them, but the ego of people who've caused damage to other people is that they always reflect everything back on themselves. So that was a kind of, you know, very difficult time. So it was baptism by fire, I think, my kind of engagement with the art world, and then it just kind of continued from there. So literally in that way, I am very much a self-declared artist in that way. So that type of work that I do, exploring all those issues and stuff to do in my family, kind of, you know, involves all kinds of things, you know, history, kind of religion, refugees, all that kind of stuff. It's all kind of there. That's the very kind of private, more controlled stuff that's in my work. And then the other stuff is this huge kind of opening up public engagement element, quite often with a kind of sense of humour as well. So those two things are run alongside each other. And I think that very much buys into why I'm attracted to quite difficult spaces, and I'm all for turning a negative into a positive. So other people come to the space where it can't be a gallery, it doesn't have a roof, it doesn't have white walls, it doesn't, and I'm the kind of opposite of that. That immediately attracts me as the kind of challenge to make something happen. So I hope that's answered your question.
I think in spades, yeah, absolutely. And the my final question, Columbo style, one more question.
Just one more question.
Before we flag up exactly how people can come and view the Superman set here.
The artist might write me threatening letters with that reference. But I think it's kind of cool. However you interpret it, I think that's great.
I've actually met one of the men who made the Superman set. He keeps at his home one of the crystals from the set. Anyway.
I was going to say he keeps a salt brick. That's
No, that would be peculiar. No, the question was, if we had a time... Well, clearly, if we had a time machine and come back 10 years into the future, it's going to be an enormous block of luxury flats. But what would you hope to see right here in, you know, 5-10 years? What's the future?
In this very space?
Let's say, yes.
Well, I don't know. Maybe it would be kind of sort of, you know, franchised out. You know, there's a kind of element... not a coffee bar.
Successful Starbucks franchise.
No. I think a space that is still exhibiting art. And, you know, this is something that can go to other spaces as well, because I think there are other huge gallery spaces that don't realise they have spaces that are underused, that someone like me could come along and kind of animate.
So this is a blueprint?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
This is a prototype.
Yeah. Yes, and I don't see why not. And also, you know, this is a very stable gallery. They have the freehold of the space. There's no reason why it shouldn't continue and grow and just get better and better. It's been here for 5 years supporting curation and experimental curation. So I can only see it kind of growing rather than the other way, you know. So maybe we'll all go international. Why not? London, New York, Paris.
I'm inclined to go international, looking at the state of those bricks. I want to get as international as possible immediately. By the way, what's the... I know this is one more question than I said I was going to ask. What's the question that you were hoping I wasn't going to ask, because it's a rubbish question?
Oh.
You must have done enough interviews for that to have cropped up.
No, not really. No question's a rubbish question, I don't think. Questioning itself is a good thing. That's my answer.
Well, that just validated my job.
Always ask why. When in doubt, always ask why.
Why? We have to come to a close. And I had some trouble finding the place, so we might need to flag. You need a bigger sign outside, I think. But we are just off the Lower Clapton Road. How would people find their way here?
Well, it's 26 Lower Clapton Road, and it's the Le Bromhof Angus Hughes. They are open from Friday through to Sunday, 12 till 6 p.m. every weekend. And the next Friday late viewing will be on the 3rd of June. And then to invite the public to come to the takedown, where you can actually own and take away a piece of this sculpture on the 26th of June. And that will be in the afternoon that we'll be inviting people down. And the nearest train station is Hackney Central, but there's lots of buses that, you know, the 106 and various other buses. If you look online, you'll find us. And also Elements Gallery is on Facebook. If you put in Elements Gallery London 1 on Facebook, and you'll find us. And we're also, Elements is on Twitter as well. Elements Gallery is on Twitter as well, so you can find our information there.
From Elements Gallery, Rebecca Filer, thanks very much.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you. My heart aches for some far off place. No one could
have left you with your name, how you raised us. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Rebecca Filer. Thanks to Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.